Welcome. Come on in. So I'll present first, under this Track 12, Religion and Technology. My paper is entitled, Technology, Theology, and the Human Person, the Contribution of Theological Anthropology to the Philosophy of Technology. Someone told me there's lots of ologies in there. Well, it's true, can I say. So when I was an engineer, I began asking questions that engineering could not answer. Questions about my social responsibilities regarding the societal impact of how technologies that I was developing, the societal impact of the technologies I was developing. There I was an engineer, and I wondered about these things. I had ethical questions, but also concerns about how technologies shape social relations. I turned to philosophy and discovered that others have been asking similar questions for some time, even though during my studies as an engineer and even in my practice as an engineer, no one was asking those questions, except being concerned about lawsuits. But other than that, not really asking many questions. So I decided to pursue further studies and ended up teaching philosophy of technology courses to engineers at an interdisciplinary center at the University of Waterloo. Then I began asking questions that philosophy struggled to answer. Questions about the ultimate purpose of technologies in a world damaged by unintended consequences that seemed inseparable from technical progress. Questions about the viability of culture and the dignity of the human person. So I turned to theology and discovered theological anthropology, which traditionally holds that human beings are created in the image of God to be like God. Here I found the basis for understanding the responsibility and the dignity of the human person. In this paper, I present three examples of questions by way of which I believe theological anthropology has potential to make a contribution to the philosophy of technology. I also present an illustration by way of a theological approach to transhumanism. The first question deals with how to resolve the seeming dichotomy between philosophical theories that hold that technologies are morally neutral, and my example would be someone like Samuel Florman, which means that they are good or bad depending upon the intentions of the users, and theories that hold that technologies are ambivalent, and I'm using the term in the way that Jacques Ellul uses it, which means that technologies are good and bad regardless of the intention of the users. In the 20th century, Catholic social teaching addressed technology by way of the social question, namely concerns regarding industrialization and the moral order of society. In the 1960s, church documents portrayed an overall sense of optimism with regards to social progress and technological development. Given the ontological goodness of creation, theologians tended to treat technologies as morally neutral instruments, and popes simply insisted that ethical steps be taken to ensure that technical progress contribute to the common good. The shift of emphasis from the social to the anthropological question corresponds to a shift from seeing technical progress as morally neutral to recognizing it as also technologically ambivalent. These assumptions about the moral neutrality of technologies are evident in the writings of the Second Vatican Council. In 1965, which happens to be the year I was born, the pastoral constitution, Gaudium et Spes, on the Church in the Modern World, it says that technical progress is presented, it presents technical progress as morally neutral, whereby its benefits are expected to be ensured by a social order that respects the human person and promotes the common good. Technologies are seen to exhibit moral neutrality in the hands of public authorities, whose responsibility it is to make decisions for the good of humanity. There's no sense that technologies themselves may be problematic, despite the best of moral intentions. Although there are glimpses of an appreciation for that technical progress may not necessarily be inherently beneficial to humanity, when concerns are raised about the way the mass media affects the youth, appropriate implementation of these technological changes is considered at this time still strictly a moral problem. The Second Vatican Council also calls for an openness in the Church to methodologies and discoveries of the human and natural sciences. By endorsing the use of sociological research, Gaudium et Spes expressed a new understanding regarding the relationship between the church and the world, one that called for Christians to merge morality with studies in the social sciences and keep a pace of scientific and technical progress. Thus, the church's social teaching must integrate social analysis with theological reflection. The challenge is similar to that faced by Catholic biblical theology when the historical critical methods were first being introduced and integrated into scriptural exegesis in the 19th century. Unlike the sciences, however, where theories can be debunked, theological doctrines are not disposable. While in philosophy, theories may be debated and discarded, theology must appropriate and reappropriate the teachings of the past. In a manner of speaking, theology must be true to the past, present, and future, while science, and to an extent, philosophy is only accountable to the present. Thus, as the Church's social teaching began to appropriate technological ambivalence, it did not discard moral neutrality. The sheer complexity of globalization challenged the Church to take into account traditional issues of morality, as well as new issues concerning the ambivalence of technical progress. Pope John Paul II recognized that globalization is ambivalent, but did not fully appreciate the implications of technological ambivalence. In the 21st century, the encyclicals of Pope Benedict XVI have expressed concern that social progress is being reduced to technical considerations that compromise the dignity of the human person. Moreover, Benedict acknowledges the ambivalence inherent in the deployment of communications technologies and the development of biotechnologies. His analysis represents a change in emphasis in Catholic social teaching from the social question to the anthropological question, namely concerns regarding competing visions of the human person in society. Nevertheless, in his encyclical Caritas in Veritate, Charity in Truth, he expresses concerns for the social order in terms that acknowledge the moral neutrality of technologies and concerns for the human person that acknowledge technological ambivalence without giving in to the temptation that human agency is powerless to shape technological development. Because theology is inclined to appropriate new theories rather than reject old ones, I see the potential here for turning to theological anthropology as a way to reconcile neutrality with ambivalence, such that the importance of moral responsibility is upheld, along with the recognition that technologies can be unintentionally detrimental to a world created good, yet marked by sin. Moreover, Benedict's theological commentary on technology implicitly acknowledges that both technological determinism and social constructivism have their place in understanding the interactions between society, technology, and the human person. The second question deals with the very notion of what it means to be a human person. Those who propose that philosophy of technology should maintain a strict secular approach that does not acknowledge any contribution from theology will have to reckon with the historical consideration that the idea of person as we understand it today originated when theologians debated doctrinal questions about God as Trinity in the 3rd century. Thus, Christian theology bases its understanding of what it means to be a human person upon the idea of personhood as revealed in the divine person of Jesus Christ. The idea of person developed when theologians used the Greek word prosopon. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly. Pardon me?
Prosopon.
Thank you. Which prior to this was used in Greek drama to designate the role a masked actor played when speaking in a dialogue. The fathers of the church interpreted the plurality of God expressed in certain passages of Scripture to be a dialogue among members of the Trinity. Tertullian was the first to apply the term to address the question of God using the formula, one being in three persons. Hence, the idea of person developed out of a Christian interpretation of the Bible in which God is understood to be a dialogical being. However, the concept of person did not mature until about 200 years later, when, in the 5th century, Christian theology articulated the meaning of God as a being in three persons by proposing that it be understood as relation. Thus, personal means relational, where in God there is a total relativity, and with the incarnation, Jesus' disciples enter into relationship with God and one another. Hence, the development of the concept of person, with the development of the concept of person, there's a shift from doctrine about God to Christology, and from Christology to anthropology. Theology developed the concept of person when addressing questions about God. When it formulated the theological truth of the union of the human and the divine natures of Christ, it drew upon ontology, and at the same time it presented ontology with a new understanding of the concept of the human person. Today it's important to make a distinction between person and personality. On the one hand, the meaning of person and personal is still associated with claims about intimacy, dignity, and uniqueness of human relationships. On the other hand, the meaning of personality is more associated with claims that are the opposite of these. A personality is someone who projects an image that is public rather than intimate. Although person, in its original theological sense, implies an ontological reality, its later spin-off, personality, is a psychological reality. Computer scientists such as Ray Kurzweil, The Age of Spiritual Machines, When Computers Exceed Human Intelligence, and Anne Forrest, God in the Machine, When Robots Teach Us About Humanity and God, claims to be a robotics theologian. They believe that progress in the ability to build machines that simulate human intelligence as well as human psychological behavior and emotions indicate that one day we will create spiritual machines that society will have to honor as persons. These technological issues revolve around questions that can be answered by turning to theological anthropology to distinguish person in the original theological and ontological sense as well as its later psychological sense, often identified today as the human subject. The third question deals with how to maintain a holistic understanding of the human person while acknowledging that contemporary technologies tend to reduce the human person to a mind that functions like a computer and a body that functions like a machine. While some anthropologies reduce the human person to one part of the totality of human existence, Christian anthropology maintains an integral wholeness. Although this wholeness is often identified as a duality of body and soul, simply dividing the human person into material and non-material components does not reflect the sophistication of the Christian tradition that is rooted in the Judeo-Christian scriptures. Thus, in addition to the commonly acknowledged realities of body, psyche, and mind, theological anthropology also takes into account realities of heart and spirit. In this way, theological anthropology expands the criteria that philosophers of technology typically consider when evaluating the development, morality, and social impact of technical progress. St. Paul did not explicitly develop a theological anthropology. However, his letters, as recorded in the New Testament, provide theology with an anthropological vocabulary. Although it's been several decades since it was first published, many theologians consider Rudolf Bultmann's Theology of the New Testament as still one of the most important foundational works in this area. Since Paul sees all creation in relationship with God, Bultmann asks what gives the human person its specifically human relationship with God. In order to answer such a question, he proposes that we must examine the formal structures of human existence in light of Paul's use of the Greek term soma, translated as body. Is that right, soma? Bultmann explains that Paul's use of spiritual lends itself to being misinterpreted by others to mean the form of the body. Bultmann insists that Paul's general anthropological principle is that human existence is somatic, even when it is spiritual, which means that the body designates the whole person. After presenting several citations from Paul, Bultmann proposes that the only plausible interpretation is that soma means personal, physical presence of the person, not something attached to a person's soul, as if that's the real self. Since he equates soma with the person's essence, Bultmann concludes that we can say that man does not have soma, he is soma. It follows that the individual faculties of human existence are found in a person's soma as a whole. The human person identified as soma becomes the being which is able to distinguish itself from itself. Since it is the nature of the human person to have a relationship with itself, the self has the possibility of being with one with itself or being alienated from itself. Paul calls this alien power sarx, that is, the flesh. And this is why, when the passions of soma take over, he says that one is living according to the flesh. I propose that Bultmann draws out Paul's vocabulary, a contemporary theological anthropology can be fashioned that addresses problems we face today regarding the fragmentation of the self due to developments like communications technologies, including the internet. Although I do not do so here, following Bultmann's lead, the same considerations can be given to Paul's use of the terms pneuma, cardia, nous, and psyche. Turning to Paul's anthropological vocabulary overcomes mind-body and body-soul dualisms by understanding the human person as an integral whole formed by spirit, heart, mind, and psyche, with and not apart from the body. In order to illustrate the sophistication with which theological anthropology can deal with technological dilemmas, consider the claims of transhumanists that machine body augmentation technologies, such as cochlear implants, artificial eyes, and thought-controlled prosthetics. Consider how these are being developed for people with disabilities, but the transhumanists claim that they should be implemented to improve the lives of people in general and even fix the human condition. This post-human understanding of the human person postulates that human dignity is to be found in our determination to modify and enhance human nature by means of technologies like genetic engineering, nanotechnology, cybernetics, and reproductive cloning. They insist that there is no human essence to preserve and that there is no need to draw a natural line limiting our use of technologies to modify ourselves. Hence, the debate between transhumanists and their critics is often characterized as a battle over the future of human nature. Theologians, such as Karl Rahner, explains in his essay, Experiment with Man, Theological Observations on Man's Self-Manipulation, he, as a theologian, presents the importance of theological anthropology while appreciating that not everyone will recognize its significance. He begins with the observation that we've always been manipulating ourselves through activities like drinking wine, shaving, educating by means of imposing knowledge. However, the situation, and he was writing in the 1970s, and I say now continues to be radically different. Plans are being put forward to change not just parts of the human person, but to change the person as human person as a totality, indeed to change humanity. As he puts it, man is discovering that he is operable. This observation is followed by an investigation in what he calls the workshops of the factory of new human beings, by which he means the fields of biology, biochemistry, genetics, psychology, and sociology. Although one might expect Rahner to rage against the transhumanist position concerning self-manipulation, he simply says, man is fundamentally operable, and legitimately so. Thus, Christians should not condemn self-manipulation as such. Moreover, he says, we should not lament the loss of what we consider to be natural. Rahner explains that he is drawing upon theological anthropology when he claims that the human person is the being who manipulates oneself and that God created the human person to be free to do what one wills with oneself. It follows that the essence of the human person is not permanent and complete like a thing, but is open and incomplete until he or she freely fashions it through actions. Although Rahner is speaking in the first instance theologically, there are ontological implications for how we react to transhumanists who claim that they are free to enhance their bodies. He proposes that today's possibilities bring to light the breadth of freedom of the human person and that it is not limited to the spiritual and intellectual dimensions, but extends to the physical, psychological, and social dimensions as well. It follows that the claim to freedom concerning the use of new technologies, as expressed by the transhumanists, not only corresponds to the freedom of the human person as understood by Christianity, it is also a product of the Christian understanding of human freedom. Rahner rejects the notion that human nature is absolutely fixed, as well as the notion that it is completely fluid. Instead, he proposes that the human person is a being with an essential nature that must be respected, while at the same time, the human person is a being who forms its own nature through culture. Since evil is ultimately the desire for what is impossible, the proper moral concern should be to show humanity that it not ought to act when it would be pointless to do so. Rahner encourages Christians to dialogue with transhumanists by pointing out that, while we may identify the same problems, we propose different solutions. Transhumanists long for transcendence and transformation through the use of technologies. Instead of arguing that they ought not to pursue these technical solutions because humans ought to restrict technologies to natural limits, it is incumbent upon Christians to convince them that what they ultimately desire is impossible to achieve through technical transformation, but is possible to achieve through spiritual transformation. From the perspective of theological anthropology, it is impossible to achieve true immortality by technical means. Transformation in Christ is not exclusively spiritual. It concerns the whole human person, who is body. Before we insist that transhumanists heed the truth of our moral theology, Christians would do well to invite them to see the beauty of our theological anthropology. The human condition cannot be fixed by us, but it can be redeemed by God. In light of this conference theme concerning the problem of insecurity, the question can be addressed whether it is possible to achieve security by technical means, and whether the solution may actually be more social, cultural, and spiritual, rather than purely technical. As we have seen, theological anthropology can sort through dichotomies, dualisms, and dilemmas by recognizing the wholeness of the human person as created by God. Charles Taylor demonstrates in his book A Secular Age that many aspects of contemporary society considered to be secular are actually manifestations of developments from within Christianity. Even professed atheists as Alain Badiou and Slavoj Žižek are turning to the Judeo-Christian scriptures to help them address the question of what it means to be human. Those philosophers of technology who are concerned about technological trends that reduce the human person to particular realities, such as the body, mind, or psyche, are invited to dialogue with theologians about what contribution theological anthropology might make to the philosophy of technology, especially when it comes to the need for appropriate limitations on the use of technologies for the sake of integral human social development that respects the dignity of the human person. Moreover, those who are Christians are invited to not be afraid of the world to come. That's my paper. Thank you. Now I get to stand over here, and there's 4 minutes for any comments or questions that you may have.
I think that one of the distinctions you're making between the transhumanists and theologians is that theologians do affirm that there is an essence to the human being.
Well, yes and no.
My question follows, but could
yes.
you please answer?
Okay.
No, go ahead with what you were saying.
Okay. Well, yes and no in that, say, using Rahner as an example, Rahner is saying that there is an essence, but it's not fixed. So that our essence is changed by our actions, and that it can be expressed through our actions.
The human being has an essence, but it's not fixed.
That's right.
And theology presumably is rooted in tradition.
Yes.
So what are his sources for that claim?
Well, this is the Christian anthropology and the notion of Christian freedom, like the notion of freedom in the Bible.
Okay.
that we're free to make choices that shape our lives and who we are and our identity, and our relationship with others.
So, my question then is, in what way does that understanding of the human being differ from, say, an existentialist understanding like in Sartre, that man has no essence?
Right.
Why is that more useful to us than, and I presume that the transhumanists are basically picking up on the idea that man has no essence.
I agree with you. And so here's where I, as a Christian, would say in the first instance, I'm not going to try to stop anybody who is a transhumanist from making these kinds of alterations, you know, using technologies to alter their bodies. But at the same time, I don't agree that they'll be able to achieve what they want to achieve because the human essence is not completely malleable. Going back to my understanding of creation, you know, that the human person is a creation, and so that there's something there that we didn't fashion ourselves. The larger claim would be, okay, that God did that, but to recognize, even if we're not talking about God, but to recognize that there's an aspect of myself that I don't completely fashion, you know, being more like, I suppose, an existentialist like Heidegger and his notion of thrownness. Mm-hmm. You know, and then you work with that, but you don't completely create your starting point, I guess.
I'm still trying to understand why that position is more viable than the position of the transhumanist.
Well, I mean, at the end of the paper, what I was suggesting is that the Christian and the transhumanist, assuming the transhumanist is an atheist, are identifying the same problem, and it's a desire for transformation. But what the theologian is saying, yes, I recognize that, but I don't think that your means is going to achieve the end that you desire, and that there are other means to achieve that end, which we'll call spiritual. So identifying the same problem but different solutions would be the way to talk about it. Please.
Two comments. First, a quick correction, actually. You talked about the idea of the prosopon and
yes.
the model, and that actually was rejected by the Nicene era. The prosopon was inferred as a role, and that was actually rejected as modalism, where the idea of the hypostasis as the person indwelling one
yes.
another was actually eventually accepted.
But it's the word that...
Yeah, but the prosopon was rejected.
Yes.
That's the point.
No, you're right.
We're not simply our roles. That they're important to us, and that even if it is paraphoretic. My question is actually,
okay.
You talked at the beginning of your paper about the idea of the human person as being made in the image of God, but didn't really want to explain what you see that meaning or why. I'm curious as to how you would identify the substance of that and where you would draw it from.
Well, that's the traditional way of considering the human person, right, in terms of theological anthropology being human person created in the image of God. And it's implicit in what I was looking at, to look at the Trinity and the relational, that being a person has something to do with capacity to be relational. I didn't develop it further because really there's been a lot of work done in developing Christian anthropology that way. And the word image is an awkward one. Which really needs to be qualified in our day, because I think it means a different thing than what we mean today by image. But the other thing is, I'm more interested in Paul's development of anthropology, his contribution to anthropology, which doesn't reject that. In fact, I think it actually develops it further. Does that make sense?
It does. It wasn't quite answering what I was asking. That's okay.
Well, I mean, why didn't I go on to develop the image of God?
There are lots of different ways. I mean, the image comes up so rarely in the Bible that it ends up just becoming a cipher for whatever people want to fill in, frankly. And so if you're going to use that kind of language, it helps to sort of say where you... If you're going to use the language, it helps to say where you're coming from on that.
That's right. And I just found that too much of a challenge to do. And I'm more interested in Paul than Genesis, although I don't reject Genesis. Yes. Okay. Very good. I'm out of time. I have to sit down. I think we have, I mean, thank you all for your comments, and I'd be happy to talk to you, any of you, more over these coming days.